Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers and electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it onto your iPod, iPad, or any device and hit play. Today, we have a real interesting show on some of the, quote, other risks associated with predictive coding, other than did it work? Several months ago, I was presenting at the Carmel Valley eDiscovery Retreat when I heard Jeff Fowler, our guest today, ask some thought-provoking questions about predictive coding and potential work product disclosure issues, and I immediately thought to myself, I have to get Jeff on a show with us, which Jeff's agreed to do. Today, we're going to focus on some of the practical issues and risks which occur when a party considers using more focused search techniques and maybe some of the solutions which can be implemented. We'll also talk more broadly about some of the recent scrutinizing lawyer search term cases, which have been published by Judge Shinlin and National Day Labor Org Network versus United States Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, and a more recent case from the U.S. District Court of New Mexico called S2 Automation LLC versus Micron Technology, which was published on August 9, 2012. To paraphrase Judge Facciola from the infamous O'Keefe decision, we are starting to tread more frequently in an area where only angels dare to tread, but being judged by hindsight on what we did. So there are so many great search issues out there that it's really difficult to even title the show appropriately, so I'm sticking with the initial premise of work product disclosure from using certain forms of predictive coding approaches when null sets are turned over, because that's what Jeff made this great observation, and it's the one that caught my attention. Jeff Fowler is an eDiscovery attorney and a partner at Melvany & Myers' Los Angeles office. He's one of the founders and leaders of the firm's electronic discovery and document retention practice. Jeff is also one of the longest-serving eDiscovery litigators in the country and one of the few whose practice is entirely dedicated to eDiscovery issues. Over the last decade, Jeff has contributed his eDiscovery expertise to well over 200 litigation department matters in virtually every area of practice. The most notable examples were representing Advanced Micro Devices in its civil antitrust lawsuit against Intel Corporation in what is considered one of the largest e-discovery cases on record. Jeff helped negotiate several precedent-setting stipulations designed to limit the otherwise infinite amount of electronic evidence in the possession of the parties and the computer manufacturers, retailers, and distributors who were subpoenaed in the AMD versus Intel case. He also helped to litigate many evidence preservations, collections, production, and spoliation questions spawned by Intel's disclosure of email preservation issues. By the way, that case would make for an excellent podcast too, Jeff, one of these days. But Jeff's a noted speaker and writer. He's a regular panelist for the Stratford teleconferences and the co-author of practice guide entitled Preserving Electronic Information, A Practical Approach by B&A Books, 2009. So let's start the show. And first of all, Jeff, how did you get started in electronic discovery?
Well, I guess it's a story that's common to many of us. I was a first-year associate, and there was a doc review. It was 1998. The doc review was paper, but the client, who was a large insurance company, was in the process of converting all of their paper files and their paper doc reviews into a scan and code review tool. And by getting involved in that one case, I ended up getting involved more generally in the client's implementation of that tool. And then fast forward a couple of years later, and after the telecommunications downfalls in around 2000, 2001, spawned by the Enron collapse, I ended up getting involved working for a telecommunications client on one of the first large e-discovery productions to the government, and sort of honed my skills there doing things like imaging hard drives and keywords and negotiating the scope of subpoenas on email, things that at the time were very brand new. And so when I came home from that exciting adventure around 2001, I was the guy around the firm who knew how to do it. And, you know, there's a movie starring Ben Stiller from a few years ago called Keeping the Faith. And in the movie, he's trying to train a young boy. He's a rabbi trying to train a young boy how to sing for his bar mitzvah. And the young boy is just struggling to sing in public and having a really difficult time. And Ben Stiller said, you just have to embrace the suckiness. And that's kind of ultimately how I ended up dedicating my practice to e-discovery. I decided, you know, I better embrace the suckiness.
You know, I was involved in a telecommunication project in about 2000 as well. It was transaction work, so it was a different one. And we had one of the first M&A systems online. And what would also make an interesting show is to talk about all of the little warts in the projects of these initial projects, because our big problem was the data was loading upside down, which caused the 30 reviewers a lot of, you know, challenges. We didn't have any trapeze artists on the team, so we had to figure that one out. But I'm sure you've got your own little stories on the imaging and loading stuff up. So.
Yeah, the good old days.
So,
the good old days when the only problem you had to face was, you know, how to read something upside down.
Yes. Well, let's jump into sort of the search area. And you've been an innovator in the e-discovery space for a while. In fact, your firm early in, engaged a linguistic firm to help design searches years ago, which would be viewed by many in the field as being fairly progressive. So, what types of issues did you consider before you embarked on that search strategy?
Well, you know, the question that we were trying to answer when we looked into aligning ourselves with H5 was, where is the future of doc review? And, you know, where is it heading? And how can we cut the cost associated with human review? You know, these are the questions that now all of us have been, you know, grappling for years, and it was no different for us. We were looking to try to figure out a way of going to clients with a solution where we could reduce the cost associated with doc review. And when we got into it, we recognized that we're talking about nowadays an information retrieval exercise. We're no longer talking about opening a box of documents and seeing what's in there. This is now a science and involving experts who know how to perform information retrieval exercises is a natural progression of where we're going. And so we liked the fact that that we could rely on experts instead of lawyers, and sort of let them go where angels fear to tread and support them with our legal knowledge, but begin to rely on them to help us do what they do best.
So now let's move the ball forward 5 years, and we now have predictive coding as a tool which at least lots of lawyers and judges are talking about and a few people are actually using. And what's the issue that you see for clients who are considering these tools versus the status quo approach of, you know, keyword searching and some form of linear review?
Well, you know, and the issue, I think, has developed over just the last couple of years. The issue is this. In this climate where there are some, you know, pending matters where the issues around how to use these tools are being hotly litigated, and where, at least for right now, what's clear is that if you want to use these tools, you really need to engage the other side and hope that the other side, your adversary, is going to understand at least on a rudimentary level how the tools work. So you're faced with a million-page doc review, and you have two options. You know, one option is to engage these tools. And right now, in light of the climate, as I said, that would require engaging the other side in a lot of the details of how you're going to formulate the review, how the seed set is going to be chosen, looking at the null set, some of the things that I know, Carl, you'd like to talk a little bit about on this panel in more detail.
Yep.
You know, the alternative is to engage 50 contract lawyers and, you know, who are going to be involved in similar methods of quality control. I mean, you know, whether you quality control 10% of your reviewer's work or 5%, or you diminish from 10% to 3%, these are the sorts of decisions that I sort of parallel with the null sets and some of the other, and the seed sets and some of these other decisions that you make when engaging technology-assisted review. They're very similar types of exercises, only traditionally, and it seems that the judges still have a good sense that those aren't things that you would typically disclose to the other side. That, in other words, you can do your review without the challenge associated with involving the other side. And why that's a challenge is not just because maybe you might be entering into a fight. That's, you know, often the case. That obviously can also be avoided. But just the practicality of it. I mean, I think that where we lose sight with predictive coding is that it came as part of a progression from doc review that is no longer simple. Human doc review, when you're dealing with 50 contract lawyers, as you know, Carl, is not simple. You have a lot of decisions. They're day-to-day decisions that you're making, not only on the contours of responsiveness and privilege, but on little issues that come up that might require re-review of certain assignments or require quality control or special quality control or learning that certain contractors didn't understand the training better than others. You know, all of those details, when you're dealing with human review, traditionally have been considered the producing party's problem and under the veil of work product and attorney-client privilege. For better or worse, I mean, not because there's any need maybe necessarily to protect that kind of detail, although often there is when you're dealing with sensitive documents, but just because of the practicalities associated with getting the documents out the door. If I have 4 to 8 weeks to produce 1 million documents and I've got to spend the first 6 weeks negotiating a protocol with the other side, and that the other side perhaps wants to enter into some healthy discussion about how that protocol is going to be developed, and the details, and we end up litigating those issues, and we end up spending the money we would have saved, you know, by going back and forth with the judge, you know, that unfortunately I have a feeling that there's been a bit of a chilling effect, you know, as a result of some of the, you know, recent suggestions that we need to have such a level of transparency and cooperation.
Yeah, and these protocols are all floating around the internet, and people write about them, you know, what's happened in some of the more high-profile cases. And I agree. It's like trying to make two people go out on a bad date. It's
That's
my
right.
analogy, and it's challenging.
Yeah, it's challenging, and, you know, and as a result, I think that it is easy for those of us even who really want to use these technologies to have difficulty suggesting to our clients that they engage in this and be the pioneers who are going to spend the money to, you know, defend their protocols to the death, which, you know, it seems that, you know, might be a risk.
And the cases that have been out there thus far, the more high-profile ones that are out there, have all been dealt with seeding with agreeing on seed documents. So let's talk about what some of that sensitivity might be. You know, if you were going to design a seed set to start your predictive coding tool, you know, what would you start doing? How would you start the process?
Well, you know, my theory is always that relevant documents are everywhere. And we can see this on Google, right? I mean, in other words, especially when you're dealing with corporate clients who, you know, have, you know, thousands of employees often, the likelihood that you will be able to capture the relevant documents across their entire universe would be prohibitively expensive in virtually any type of lawsuit. So the first thing that needs to happen is there needs to be some practical decision making on source. Where are we going to limit ourselves from a source standpoint? Given that we could search, you know, a large company's documents and find that some newsletter that is sent to every employee might be relevant, and therefore, you know, or some emails between people who aren't involved in the case might relate to the topic, that really the only way to cabin and put some sort of sense around the exercise, you know, is what we've been doing now for years, all of us, which is, you know, looking at particular custodians, key sources. You know, so absolutely the first step is to define where you're going to look. Key custodians is always a good bet. I know that nowadays there's a lot more in the way of interactive sourcing, you know, SharePoints and you know, file servers and other places where documents are located, and those need to be considered. But the advantage to custodians is that they're human beings and you can speak to them. So, you know, first and foremost, you find out who those key custodians are and you find out where the sources are. And then you can speak to the key custodians. And because this exercise, the exercise of seeding, you know, isn't the exercise of getting every single relevant document, you can rely a little bit more on the custodians for what they think is relevant and have them point things to you so that you can get a sense of what the key documents look like, because that's the exercise. It's not so much getting the key documents, it's getting a sense of what they look like. And then once you've gathered a sample of those documents from your key custodians, you can use those key documents to find other key documents. And, you know, participating in that kind of exercise, you know, often is very productive even before creating your seed set. You know, and that borrows from, again, information retrieval and sort of what the search scientists do, you know, which is you give them documents, and then they spend a significant amount of time studying the population. And they, you know, study the language within the documents, and they get a sense of how people are communicating, and that's how they begin to create their seed set. So, you know, starting with discrete sources, then talking to those sources, if they're humans, and finding out what they think is relevant, looking at exemplars and trying to find more of the same, and then that's where that can be a foundation for building a seed set.
So today we have judges at conferences talking about sharing null sets, which are non-responsive documents coded as such based on the seed set and the documents which are being loaded in the system to train the tool. And if the data being shared were not a seed set but were randomly generated, like several predictive coding tools are engineered to train on, do you have the same concern with sharing a few thousand seeding documents with the other side, including non-responsive documents?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think this is a real significant
issue. Seems like
issue.
The risk is down, but it's still there, you know, but it's you know, it's not your mental process of where you're trying to search.
That's right. But here's the, you know, just some practical examples of where this becomes a non-starter, which is, you know, litigants who are facing the same adversaries in varieties of different types of lawsuits. Maybe it's, you know, pharmaceutical companies who deal with the same, you know, lawyers who are suing them for different drugs. So when you start providing access to documents that have nothing to do with the case and might relate to another drug or another product or another, you know, highly confidential business transaction, that you are even under the best case scenario, providing more than the law requires, and as a result of that, potentially exposing yourself to additional liability. And that's the where that becomes a real non-starter. There's a reason why, up until now, we haven't provided non-responsive documents. And that goes back to my point, Carl, about I just don't understand, although I know where it comes from, but I'm just sort of I'm reluctant to put predictive coding in its own special category. There is a variety of ways to review documents. Predictive coding is the most recent. But we've been for years using all sorts of methods to try to parse the relevant from the non-relevant. And there have been risks associated with each of those different methods. And there's nothing, in my view, unique about the way that predictive coding works that necessarily changes that requirement or obligation or more to the point, need. Because what you've got is a situation where by requiring or by suggesting even that the parties are going to be able to open the doors of the review center, which is the equivalent, right? I mean, Carl, in our, you know, other matters, you've got 50 contract lawyers in a room. You train them by sitting down with them, giving them a PowerPoint presentation perhaps with a binder of materials. You train them, which is basically training the software, right? The software in this case being human beings. You sit down with them. You train them on the substance of the case. You train them on your positions of the substance of the case as well, of course. You then set them off in a room and you monitor them. And you walk the halls and you see what they're picking up as responsive and what they're picking up as non-responsive, and you evaluate the quality of your review as you go. What we're talking about here with predictive coding is basically inviting the adversary to that party. And, you know, the problem with that is that there are confidentiality concerns that extend beyond the responsive documents. There are documents are the heart of any case. And as I was saying before, you have clients who are repeat targets for litigation. And so for them to, expose themselves to more than just the responsive documents in order to reduce the cost is a real difficult balance, because ultimately the cost savings, you know, needs to be very, very great.
And for some it is. I mean, some people are experimenting that are playing by these rules. They look at 73 cents on a dollar going to and running this tanker ship of review where you're trying to keep everyone on the same page. And looking at these other approaches and saying, you know, we're going to experiment. And, you know, maybe the rules will evolve in a direction where everyone can be more comfortable once we fleshed out this type of issue, which is, you know, one of the reasons I like doing these shows.
Yeah.
Because there's got to be other ways to get comfortable. I mean, how do we get comfortable today? I mean, is your bond, your word, or, you know, could sampling be used a little bit? There's got to be.
Traditionally, how we've been comfortable is the other side has an incentive to be accurate, because if they're not, they are attesting that they have produced the responsive documents, and if something comes out that evidences that they did not, then they could be on the hook for sanctions. And there have been recent cases where that's happened. So there is an incentive for the producing party to take this seriously. And in so many areas of litigation, we rely on the bond of the other side. It's in the rules. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure require us as lawyers to sign on the dotted line in so many ways, whether it's an interrogatory response. I mean, you know, I guess technically, you know, you give your interrogatory response, and I guess using the same formula here, the other side could go and, you know, conduct the same interviews and do the same sort of work product that you did in order to get to your response to the interrogatory. I mean, I know that they have the capability of doing that through depositions, but the same is true with doc review. They can, if the key custodian's documents were not produced in a complete way, that's going to come out in the deposition in some respects. And so, you know, the point is that our efforts to perfect document discovery, although, you know, noble efforts that I'm very much a part of, you know, I mean, there's an incentive to reduce cost, there's an incentive to be accurate, to end up bringing that into the courtroom and bringing that into a collective discussion about, the accuracy of it has more of a chilling effect than a productive effect. And actually, I think the example I use, Carl, I think, you know, you and I may have talked.
You know, there's an idea here, and it's what we did in global aerospace. You know, if you have an idea of where there's a problem with this, I mean, frankly, what's happened in this other case is, in the Virginia case, is the other side didn't want to do predictive coding. They wanted to use keywords, and they characterize it as being a simple exercise. So, you know, the pleading, the briefs are all in public record. You know, basically what was said on our side was, this is what it would roughly cost to do it this way. And we don't want to do it this way. We want to do it a different way, and we'll go ask the court. And the court said, go ahead and do it. Now, I suppose if we'd had the same concern in that type of case, that you know, maybe if it was a serial litigant or something like that, and you know, that you know, maybe the next lawyer that makes that same argument says, we don't want to turn it over, and this is why. And this is, you know, a growth in the field. And if you're going to tell me I have to do it, turn it over, then we're not going to do it. We're going to then just do a linear review, and we need more time. And put it in front of a judge that way. I mean, that gives your client the choice, doesn't it? And maybe the judge the choice.
It does. I mean, it's funny because You know, I joke that I'm a professional cooperator. I mean, that's all, as a full-time e-discovery lawyer, that's all I do. I literally, and as you mentioned, Carl, like, I don't do any other. When I'm litigating, it's over preservation issues. It's over IT-related issues. My practice is entirely e-discovery. And so I spend most of my day meeting and conferring on dozens of different matters here at the firm. And I am a big proponent in cooperating and transparency, because I don't believe in involving ourselves in unnecessary disputes. It's a philosophy that has stood me well. But when it comes to the details of doc review itself, I feel that we go down, there's the risk of going down a road that is just going to lead to more litigating than less on these topics. And so, you know, my view is that there may also be a strategy where you review the documents as you choose to review them, and then once the production has happened, where there is a chance for the other side to really look at things, you know, to really examine the results, and who could hire a search scientist to get into the production and see what's there and what possibly isn't there. And I've been in matters where the other side has hired experts, you know, to look around what's in a production. And there are certainly cases on record where, especially in the preservation context, where that's been done in an effort to see what's been preserved and what hasn't. You know, that the fight could happen in the motion to compel stage as opposed to up front. And the reason why I might advocate for that in certain instances, Carl, is because otherwise you end up spending a lot of time, you know, there's this idea that we want to get everything done up front to avoid dispute.
Mm-hmm.
But often what happens, and we see it in the preservation areas too, is that you end up inviting a dispute before the facts are in. You know,
really, the other side just wants some documents to start looking at the case and to start moving it ahead. And as you say, you never have all the documents, but if you have enough to make your case or to bring it forward or defend it, you know, then that's the process.
That's right. And given that we have the issue of discovery taking up too much time, and in particular too much of the court's time, there is some advantage of saying, look, you know, Carl, if I were the judge, you know, if I were a judge, I'd say, look, go produce your documents, then let's talk. You know, let's see. Once you've, you know, I realize there's a risk that it's going to be so botched that it's going to slow things down because there's going to be a redo. But in the routine cases, in most cases, that's likely not to happen. So rather than, you know, sort of encourage or suggest that the best thing to do is to come forward and hammer these things out in the abstract, you know, there may be some advantage to just doing it.
Yeah,
you know,
no, that makes sense. One of the areas that I sort of want to move from away from predictive coding is, you know, but if you include this whole world of search as you described it, you know, predictive coding or linguistic approach or whatever, it seems like it's getting much more complicated. The data sources are more complicated. The tools are more complicated. The experts are more complicated. You know, is there a risk for lawyers not to understand how they actually did the search now? I guess it's happening, right? We talked about
it
in the beginning.
I think it's, yeah, you know, here's the thing. I always feel like the biggest risk is, you know, they always say, like, knowing just enough to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the real risk is having a confidence in your search methods without kicking them around, without really understanding and being able to articulate what you've done. And nowadays, and this is just sort of, you know, this has just become, for me, kind of a no-brainer, particularly after, you know, Judge Paciola's point, you know, and just where we're heading with keyword searching, Judge Shindlin's more recent opinion. You know, that ultimately we are talking about, as I said at the top of the show, an information retrieval exercise. And I know that I can get on Google and do a pretty good job of finding that restaurant in my neighborhood that I like. You know, but I'm not a search expert. And if we need to testify about how searches were conducted, I'm not going to be the one to testify. I'm going to be the one to conduct the direct examination. So, you know, I need an expert. And that's, to me, where we're heading with this. And, you know, in particular, large cases where there's a lot at stake, and therefore maybe the searches are more hotly litigated. You know, we're just at a point, like other areas of the law, where if you're going to be litigating these issues, then the issues are going to require expertise and in the form of a testifying expert, not unlike trying to prove causation or any other area that lawyers wouldn't sort of expect to testify on. So you're right that, you know, things are getting more complicated. You know, I attribute that largely to technology and where we're heading just generally with the convenience of all of these various devices that we are enjoying. You know, that where we're heading with that then is that now discovery has become an expert exercise.
Yeah, it's definitely I think a lot more interesting. You know, for opening up boxes and looking for paper was nowhere near as much fun as
yeah,
trying to
exactly.
understand data cesspools and how do you get it out, and you know, and at what point do you run out of money, or how do you defend it? You know, there's so
mm-hmm.
many great issues here. It's definitely a lot more fun.
It sure
so,
is.
So with that, you know, sort of an ending to this, I guess it pays to be as much of an expert as you can be as a lawyer, but know when you're getting in a little, when maybe it's gotten a little bit too complex and you're going to need some help.
That's right. And I mean, I wouldn't be a full-time e-discovery lawyer if I didn't believe that discovery has now become its own specialty, and that the people who are going to be best qualified to aid clients in making these difficult decisions are people who make these decisions on a daily basis, because things are moving so quickly. You know, it's even difficult to keep up on the advances of the e-discovery industry as an e-discovery lawyer, let alone someone who, you know, is also trying to keep up on the latest developments in antitrust or patent or some of these other very complicated areas that are left to the specialists. So, you know, again, in large cases, it just seems that the best thing to do is to involve people who've done this before.
So the last question I sometimes like to ask our guests is now we're here on September, I guess it's 18th or something like that. What issue do you see as the biggest issue in the e-discovery field today? Might be my next show. You never know. I like
that's right.
Get these. Go ahead. What
well,
do you see?
Here's what I like to say, Carl, is that, you know, the tail wags the dog. You know, we are chasing technology. And in particular, there is a multi-billion-dollar service industry that is chasing litigation support technology. And with every advance comes a new issue. But similar to other areas of technology, we've become so sophisticated that our standards of perfection have heightened. And I think that one of the big issues that will be facing us, you know, in the next few years is an uptick in e-discovery litigation, where there is, you know, even more discovery on discovery, even more disputes over how documents are going to be reviewed, preservation, collection issues. The more sophisticated we get, the more the service industry provides technological solutions that require expertise to understand, the more there will be disputes over these issues. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon those of us who practice in this area to take a sobering step backward and, you know, ask ourselves whether solving these issues, you know, in the public forum of a courtroom is really doing anybody any favors, and whether we might be better off sort of calming down a bit and not expecting so much of ourselves.
Well, that was almost Judge Facciola-ish. So that was you picked some common themes I've seen him throw out there. So I thought that was a good answer.
Oh, great.
So Well, with that, I'm going to conclude our show. And Jeff, thanks for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you and other experts like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd like to also thank our sponsor, Jernov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI Information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.